Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening. This is Ariel Montserrat, and I'm with my co-host tonight, Sylvie Selou, and you're listening to the Green Egg Radio Hour. Tonight is Winter Solstice Eve, with the winter solstice officially being tomorrow, December 2nd. In 2012, the earliest winter since 1896 arrives with the solstice at 6:12 a.m. on December 21st Eastern Standard Time, 3:12 a.m. Pacific Standard Time, so that's tomorrow morning. Tonight will be the longest night of the year. Traditionally, pagans stay up all night to greet the dawn and celebrate the solstice.
This is the shortest day of the year, the time when the sun reaches its southernmost point in the sky. Although this part of Earth is cooling, its great thermal mass still retains some heat from summer and fall. As the gradual cooling process continues over the next 2 months, temperatures will continue to fall and the coldest temperatures will be recorded. The same pattern holds true for the summer solstice in June, as the year's highest temperatures are recorded later in July and August.
There are many traditions around the world that celebrate winter solstice and or this time of year, and I won't go into them all of them tonight because I'm pretty sure most of my our listeners are familiar with most of the usual ones. But here's an unusual one. On the last day of the year, the Scots call it Hogmanay and celebrate it by cleaning their homes. Gotta love those partying Scots. They really know how to have a good time, huh? Jeez. You know, that's like the last thing I want to do on the last day of the year. Anyway. So, now on to introducing tonight's special guest, Stephen Emrys. And Sylvie's going to tell you a little bit about him.
Well, Stephen is a journalist and an educator who has written on subjects as diverse as history and religion, politics, and language. He has also written and edited several many textbooks for elementary children on subjects such as mythology and I hope I'm saying this correctly, Hatshepsut?
Hatshepsut. I think it is what it is. It's a very difficult one.
Yeah, she was Egypt's first female pharaoh.
Mm-hmm.
His most recently published project is an original fairy tale for children and it's titled Feathercap.
He has served as an editor for fiction and nonfiction projects, and his first book, The Gospel of the Phoenix, was published in the summer of 2012. In addition to Feathercap, he has published three other books in 2012, Requiem for a Phantom God, The Phoenix Principle, and Undefeated. All are available in paperback and Kindle, and some are also available for Nook, the Nook reader.
Stephen lives on California's Central Coast with his wife, Samair, author of Mad World series, and with his stepson. They share their home with a dog named Zip and a cat named Isis.
So, welcome, Stephen.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
Yeah. So one of the things that you mentioned that you'd like to talk about tonight is pagan atheism. Can you tell us what that is?
Well, that's the idea that you can actually be a pagan and not worship a god or gods or goddesses. Most pagans, I think, are probably would describe themselves as polytheists, people who worship many gods. But there are pagans out there who are not focused on worship of a deity or worship of a deity in the sense that many people worship deities, gods with names such as Zeus and Isis and Aphrodite. But there are many also pagans out there who are pantheists, who believe that nature itself is divine and revere nature as kind of the ultimate expression of reality. And there are many people I've talked to in the pagan community who, for them, that's the the ultimate thing that defines paganism is a connection to nature. And so how you define that connection, whether you define it in terms of gods and goddesses or in terms of just the forces of nature, to me it shouldn't make that much difference. I describe myself as a more secular pagan. I'm not one who worships gods and goddesses in the traditional sense. However, I do have a great reverence for nature and believe that nature itself is what many people would call magical or wonderful, or wondrous, or even divine. And I think there is room within the pagan community for both expressions of philosophy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I have to agree with that because I identify as a pagan agnostic. And I'm often told that, that's contradictory.
That you don't exist.
Exactly, but, you know.
How do you respond to them, Sylvie? I'm
just curious. I just explain to them that, you know, I don't see identify with energies. I'm more
mm-hmm.
scientific-minded.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that paganism evolves just like everything else, and they're just, you know, we're not in cave person day anymore. We're not, you know, we're more educated now, and it's not that I want all those energies by their names, you know, and I enjoy all of that, but in mind, I can see where these energies come from. I understand them better, and I can see the cause and effect and just understand it. So to me, you know, it's not a god. It is just part of nature.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I like that description. That's nice.
I think in many ways we define ourselves too literally, and we define the things around us very literally. When in fact, if we would look at things more in a metaphorical sense, or in a sense of let's go beyond the symbols that these things represent, the names of gods and goddesses, to the essence behind it. That somehow is sometimes more difficult to do because you have to discard the idea that in a Christian sense, people are often saying, well, there's this big guy up there in the sky with white hair and a beard. And of course, Christians don't really believe that, but there's some sense of that literal, anthropomorphic, almost human type of a deity that we're dealing with. It's comforting. I think pagans often have that same sort of comforting feeling that we're dealing with deities who have human faces. And what I would say is that there is so much more beyond that symbolism that is to be explored and to be really marveled at. That the idea of stopping at just the symbolism and saying, well, there's this human-type entity out there. I don't believe these entities that are called gods are human-type entities. I think that they transcend humanity and represent something far deeper and more complex. And I think that the habit that we have of talking about them in human terms sometimes robs us of the deeper meaning that is behind that symbolism. And so that's what I encourage people to look for, and I know many pagans do this. But I've also encountered people who are just appalled at the idea that, well, you can't be a pagan atheist, or you can't be a secular pagan. You can't be a pagan without worshiping the Lord and Lady or acknowledging a specific pantheon. And I would just say that I'm not saying there's anything wrong with doing that, but I think there's so much more beyond that could enrich our lives if we look beyond the symbolism and recognize that the symbolism is a gateway to something deeper rather than an end in itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. What kind of response do you get when you use this term? I mean, you just mentioned a minute ago about you get some unusual responses, I guess.
Well, my wife, Samara, and I run a page on Facebook called Pagan News Now, and I think many of the listeners might be familiar with that. We have a fairly large website following there. And the response was really diverse when I put up a picture mentioning pagan atheism. And there were those who said, well, that's just wonderful because pagans and atheists have many things in common. We're both members of groups that have been historically oppressed by the mainstream monotheistic religions. And as such, we can support each other and we can understand where each other is coming from based on the fact that we've both been persecuted. We've both been on the receiving end of folks who don't like the way we believe. Then there were those who didn't understand it. There were a lot of people who questioned and said, what does this mean? How is this possible? And so I wrote a blog to try to explain some of that. And Sylvie, you wrote a great response, I thought, too, on that thread that was just a wonderful elucidation of what I was trying to say. And then there were those who said, this is absolutely impossible. This is an anathema. And it said things like, well, Christians have been accusing us of being godless for so long. How can you say that pagans can be godless? Aren't you just feeding into the Christian accusation of us being godless? And my response to that is, why is being, quote unquote, godless necessarily anything negative? It's it's just a different way of looking at things.
And why do we have to conform to somebody else's, views? I mean, it's kind of, isn't that why we're pagan?
Right, and that's one of the things that drew me to paganism in the first place is the incredible diversity of beliefs and of expressions of belief within the community, and the general lack of judgmentalism that I found within the Christian community. I was involved in the Christian community before I became pagan. And during that time, was experienced many examples of judgmentalism from people if you didn't conform to specific ways of believing within the Christian milieu. I haven't experienced as much of that within paganism, but I got a little bit of that when I put the idea of pagan atheism out there. And I was a little bit surprised, to be honest. I thought that there would be a little bit more acceptance or a little bit less judgmentalism than there was, because there was a lot of acceptance when I put it out there, but there was also a lot of questioning and judgmentalism, too.
Wow. Pagan fundamentalism, huh?
Well, yeah, and unfortunately that is... It's, you can find fundamentalism in just about anything, and paganism is certainly no exception.
Yeah, I mean, there will always be people who take things literally, you know.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow.
I think that's the danger of any religious belief is the idea that you fall into this black and white thinking, that you fall into this idea that everything is meant to be taken literally, and before you know it, you're defending the literalism as though that's the essence of the religion.
Mm-hmm.
And so you become very dogmatic, and
arguing about theology.
Right, you lose the spiritual essence that started the religion in the first place. And most spiritual beliefs start as an attempt to connect with spirituality, not as an attempt to form some sort of dogmatic, fundamental, written code. And in paganism, there isn't that. There are many different books, which I think is wonderful, because you can go and you can read Scott Cunningham, or you can read Oberon's material, you can read mine, you can read any one of a number, Isaac Bonowitz, any one of a number of people's material, and you can find these different perspectives, and they're all enriching perspectives. You may not agree with all the aspects of any of them, but some aspects of them will enrich your life.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not something you can get within the mainstream Christian, for example, or Muslim communities, which are bound up by the Bible as being the touchstone or the Quran as being the touchstone, and everything must conform to these beliefs that are found in these manuscripts. We don't have that. I think that's great. I think it's very free.
Mm-hmm. We're free to create our own religion, basically, from our own beliefs.
Right.
Yeah.
It's very experiential and it's very philosophical. And I've written a few philosophical books that came out of my experience from Christianity and as I was coming into my experience of paganism, that I felt free to write these books that were challenging to other beliefs, not in a sense of, I don't like these beliefs, but in a sense of, do these beliefs make sense for me,
mm-hmm.
personally? Do they make sense logically? Do they make sense philosophically? Do they form the basis for a spiritual understanding or an understanding that respects your fellow human being, respects the earth? When I start to ask those questions as being my fundamental basis for believing something, then I don't have to worry about what this or that God said or what this or that scribe in the name of this or that God said 4,000 years ago before we had scientific explanations for certain things that rendered those beliefs really obsolete. And yet you have within fundamentalism this idea of we need to carry on these old beliefs. And there is something to be said for old beliefs and old ways and traditions. They make people feel more comfortable. They often have wisdom that is lost through time because in our quest for a more secure world or a more convenient world, we might lose sight of some of those things. And those things are valuable. But on the other hand, to hold to things that have been disproved or have been superseded by greater knowledge, it seems to me that it's counterproductive. We're short-shrifting ourselves if we do that.
Mm-hmm. I agree. I really agree. And it also, I think, makes the religion fossilize, because any system that doesn't grow, it's going to just become paralyzed and bogged down with its own dogma, self-importance, whatever.
Right.
So, yeah.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that we don't have as nearly as much of that within paganism as you see in other religions. And what I fear is that part of that may be the fact that we're a minority religion and we don't have the power to institute a dogma. I would be very curious as to see what would happen to paganism if it became the dominant religion. Would we then seek to impose a dogma upon other people because we'd have the power to do so? I would hope not. But having studied Christianity and seeing how much Christianity depends on previous pagan religions, mm-hmm. I have to wonder, Christianity is just a pagan religion that happened to become the dominant one and sought to impose itself on others. And that's scary.
Yeah, you know, I remember having a conversation with Oberon Zell Ravenheart not that long ago about some of this, and he told me that in the beginning, when the elders were sort of building the pagan, you know, community back in the 60s and 70s and 80s, that they, especially the 60s and 70s, they asked themselves that question: how do we keep ourselves from becoming what we don't like, which is the Christian church? You know, so many of us ran from the Christian church. How do we keep from becoming dogmatic and solidified and smug and self-righteous and all of that? And to my knowledge, nobody ever really came up with an answer. You know, it's really probably a dialogue that maybe we should have. What do you think?
I would agree. I don't. I wasn't involved in those discussions, so I don't know what came out of those. I'd be interested to find out what actually did, because I think that it would just be fascinating to see the process that went into discussing that.
Mm-hmm.
I think that discussion is always relevant.
Yeah.
And it should be a continual discussion that's had, not just once, but throughout the development of any spiritual
mm-hmm.
path. And, oh, and really? A discussion that's had individually and within or among people who profess the same beliefs. So to guard against that false civilization that you're talking about.
Yeah.
Well, one thing I've noticed, I deal with a lot of different pagan groups, and there are so many people who have become solitaries for the sole purpose of trying to join a group or a coven or what have you. They found that they're being told, well, this is the way you're going to do it. You know, it's this is the way it's done. If you're not going to do it this way, then, you know, we'll see you later.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're already seeing that it's my way or the highway mentality, such as Christianity holds. And I think
mm-hmm.
until a lot of coven leaders realize that, you know, people are going to come in with different views, and that these have to be sorted out and talked about, accepted, and what have you, that we're not going to see any solid agreement within the entire pagan community.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I know of one coven leader, and I think they're listening tonight, dear friend Connie, who heads a coven here in Tennessee, and she is the closest that I've seen to someone who accepts everyone, and she will listen, you know, and exchange views, and she'll incorporate ideas that other people have. And to me, it's just a very wonderful environment to be in, and I wish that everyone could be a lot like her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think what you're experiencing is something that's fairly common within the pagan community. As you said, many people are becoming solitary or choosing to remain solitary because they don't like the political battles that are fought, witch wars and favoritism and dogmatic constraints that are placed upon them within a social context. I've been involved in the San Diego pagan community in a peripheral way, since I don't live there. But I found those folks down there to be very welcoming and very easy to get along with. And I think that's great. But I've also been involved in other situations where I have felt unwelcome and felt as though I needed to conform to a certain requirement in order to be a part of building that community. And I felt like I can respect their course of action, but I don't necessarily agree with it, and it's not something I can necessarily go along with. And they're just, I think, a very big, a very diverse spectrum of attitudes within the pagan community, and some are very constraining and some are very freeing. And I think we need to, I would hope that we would promote the freeing attitudes so that more people can take part in those situations and feel that they can still be themselves. It's something, it's an empowering thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah, not be forced into some, you know, somebody else's box. Yeah.
Right.
Jello mold.
Go ahead.
When I lived in San Francisco Bay Area, we had a festival every year, a gathering at Harbin Hot Springs called Ancient Ways. And it was wonderful because people from all pagan paths were there. And everybody got along. Everybody would, you know, calmly discuss or debate, you know, their various beliefs or traditions and things like that. And it was really literally mind-expanding. It opened you up. And it was a wonderful, wonderful thing. Unfortunately, it's not there anymore because, you know, sometimes festivals sort of lose their juice, something else happens, and people move on. But I haven't really seen that kind of togetherness at most of the festivals that I've been at back east. And granted, I haven't been to a lot, but when I go to Starwood and like that, some of it's there, but more locally. The small, it seems to be the smaller the group, the more that that happens.
Hmm.
Yeah, to me. Anyway, let's see. We, what I wanted to ask you is about your new book, Undefeated. And this just came out, what, this week, I think?
Actually, it came out late November, so it's been about a month now.
Oh, okay.
And, yeah, that's that's a great segue in the sense that this book was written to highlight the idea that anybody in any community can be on the receiving end of prejudice or bigotry or bullying. And it's not an entirely pagan book or an entirely anything book, and it's that for a reason. The idea is that you can find yourself, and there's a series of 45 vignettes about people who have overcome prejudice. And of these 45, I think maybe a handful are pagan, but they're not. There are several people who are Christians who are oppressed for being Christian. There are several who were oppressed for being Jews. There's one vignette about a woman who was oppressed for being Roma, and there's one for several people who were oppressed because of their race. The Japanese internment camps being one example. South Pacific slave trade took place, and several people who were African American or Native American who were oppressed because of that, and women as well. It's meant to cover the spectrum of and bind us together in the concept of anyone can be on the receiving end of this. So please think twice before you are on the giving end of it, because someone in your own community has been on the receiving end of this at some point in time, and it's a karma thing. It's an idea that we're all in this together, and we shouldn't be taking sides and oppressing people and bullying people. I was a victim of bullying as a child, and so that's very close to my heart. I don't want to have people be on the receiving end of it, because I know how painful that is. It's very painful. It can be very destructive, and yet it's going on. Fortunately, there's more of an awareness of it these days, but it's still going on all across the country, all across the world. And I just want to do whatever I can to bring an awareness within our community and within the community at large of the destructiveness of bullying and of bigotry and of the human spirit that can overcome that. I don't want it to be just a downer that, oh, there are these people who are bullying people, isn't that terrible? But in fact, a clarion call that this is something that can be overcome, and look at these people who, through their courage and through their perseverance, have overcome these incredible odds and these incredible obstacles that have been placed in front of them by people who just didn't want them to be themselves.
Yeah. It's soul murder, really. It can be, I think.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
What do you attribute the rise in bullying these days, Stephen?
I think whenever people get scared, they want a scapegoat.
Mm-hmm.
And we've had, within the past few years, economic crisis. We've had more people unemployed. We've had more people homeless, more people in very difficult situations. And when you get in a difficult situation, you look for somebody to blame. And there are many people out there who, rather than saying, this is an opportunity for me to persevere, will play the victim and say, oh, it's those people over there, which the Salem witch trials being a classic example, and another, and that was not just confined to Salem in the 17th century. It actually occurred in Connecticut and some other places in New England, and was brought over from the old country. One of the vignettes in Undefeated is about a woman in Connecticut named Mary Bliss Parsons, who was accused not once in her life, but was accused twice of being a witch, in a very negative sense. And she was brought to trial for this, And her husband, fortunately, was one of these people who stood by her and said, "I'm not going to stand for this. We're going to go to trial and we're going to fight this." And they did, and they ended up on the winning end both times, thank goodness. But that often didn't happen because people wanted someone to blame. If the economy was bad, well, it's got to be somebody laying a curse on us. It's not a problem of, say, corporations wanting too much money, but somebody's laying a curse on us. And so that's bad in two ways. And in one way, it scapegoats somebody who's not responsible for it. And then on top of that, you're ignoring the actual problem that is responsible for it. So that continues. Mm-hmm.
Excellent point.
I think, too, with a lot of bullying and persecution and things that go on, of course, there's a fear factor if you've got something that's large scale, like what happened with the Jewish people and with the Armenian people. I just finished Stephen's book, and it's good. But people tend to want to belong to a group. There's, as humans, you know, we're basically animals. And if you watch nature, it's this pack mentality. The thing that separates us from just total wild animal is that not only the opposable thumb deal, but we have a higher mind where we can decide. We can decide whether we're going to be mean or we're going to help someone up that's an underdog. And I would hope that people would choose the underdogs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I see a lot of arguments on the internet about, you know, if you stand up for someone who's being bullied, well, you're hit with, well, now aren't you becoming a bully? Well, in some instances that does happen, but you know, if you do not stand up and say this is, I've had enough,
mm-hmm.
what's going to happen?
Mhm. And what does that say about you? Yeah.
And I've seen that same argument often posed as, well, you're standing up to bullies, you're being intolerant. And I think to myself, I'm fighting against people who are intolerant. If you're intolerant of somebody who's intolerant, that's actually a good thing, because you're
mm-hmm.
saying, we're not going to allow you to impose your beliefs on other people. It's not a question of being intolerant of them. It's a question of standing up to them and saying, there are other people who believe differently than you do. And
mm-hmm.
those people have just as much right to believe and express those beliefs as you
mm-hmm.
do. So stop.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I need to step in here, and it's time for our halftime break, and we have a song by one of our favorite pagan musicians, Kenny Klein. And if you're new to Green Egg, Kenny Klein does a blog that we have up on our Green Egg Zine page. It's Green Egg Zine, ZINE.com, and Kenny's a really wonderful musician, and he has a new CD out, and we're going to be playing a song from his CD that was just out before this, called Marie Laveau, about a person and a woman in New Orleans.
Along the river bright and the bayou churning, they danced veiled in white to the fires burning. Maidens called Bambula, Jimbe conscious souls. Below I gathered soon there around Marie Laveau. Down on Congo Square, the insistent beating, when rum was shared and the dove wings beating, the rhythms echoed long then, on the river's flow. Egrets heard the song of Marie Laveau. You can carve an X on a grave if you can find it. You can leave all the mojo you have, and she will find it. By live oak and by palm, by heron and by crow, you can leave your cares beside Marie Laveau. Ride me like the river, ride me like the tide, take me past the crossroads to the other side. Ride me like the river,
ride me like the river,
ride me like the tide.
And that was Kenny Klein with Marie Laveau. And we're back here at the Green Egg Radio Hour with Stephen Emrys discussing his new book, Undefeated, about racism and discrimination. And we were just talking about the bullying that's going on currently in the country. I would like to add also that it seems to me when I read the news, Stephen, that law enforcement, in many ways, have become just thugs. It's beating up old people, handicapped people, mentally ill people, tasering them, even shooting them. And it's amazing how many people, when they get into police custody, are handcuffed with their hands behind their back and somehow still manage to commit suicide by shooting themselves in the head, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So it's things like that. And I think what's happened is in this country that people with a bully mentality, people who were frustrated with not being able to have work when they want it and the rising cost of, you know, everything, I think they're feeling hopeless and they're looking around for a scapegoat, like you say, just like in Nazi Germany. And they have gotten the idea that it's okay. It's really okay to do this. I mean, the cops are doing it, you know, the government's doing it. So that's my idea anyway.
I think there's something to that. And I think people who are frustrated sometimes take the or gravitate toward positions where they can impose their authority, where they can gain authority and impose it on other people. And I think it's important to point out that there are plenty of good police officers out there who aren't in the field for that.
Mm-hmm.
That they really care about the community and want to make a difference.
Yeah.
And so I don't want to make a broad brush condemnation of police officers because I that would be unfair.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that would be unfair.
However, there was a study that was done something like 40 years ago now in Stanford. It was the Stanford Prison Study, and it was a fairly famous study involving some students at Stanford University, if I remember correctly, who were chosen just out of the general student population. They weren't thugs or bad guys, and they weren't authoritarian necessarily, but they were placed in a situation where half of them chosen at random were to play the role of inmates in a prison, and the other half were to play the role of guards. And they had to stop this study about halfway through it because it became so there was so much abuse on both sides. The people who had been just regular students who were assigned the roles of prisoners started to act like prisoners, the people you'd see in prison, and started to act out criminal behavior. And on the other hand, the people who had been assigned the role of guards started to act out guard-type behavior of just assuming that anything these people did who were assigned as prisoners was bad and would come down on them in a very authoritarian fashion. And it was a very enlightening experience because it showed that people, if placed in certain roles, will often end up conforming to what's expected of those roles. And that's scary.
It is. It reminds me, there's another study similar to that with pushing the button, and they were told that they would be causing pain to people. They would be getting electrocuted, I think it was. And you may be familiar with this study. And people were told to continue hitting the button, to keep on. And they weren't really hurting anybody, but the people thought they were. And they just kept right on because somebody in authority told them to keep doing that, you know. That's pretty scary. It's like humans aren't. Go ahead.
I remember that study. They had that on a documentary on television.
Mm-hmm.
And that was very interesting, especially to watch the body language of some people who were pushing the button. A majority of them really didn't want to.
Mm-hmm.
They were very hesitant, and you could just see that it was taking all that they could push up to actually push the button. But then there were a few, it didn't bother them at all.
No.
And as I was watching this, I thought, well, it brought to me the psychological makeup of some different people.
Uh-huh.
Because we, you know, we're always here seeing the word sociopath or psychopath out there in, you know, in society. And I tend to believe that we do have more sociopaths on our hands than we do psychopaths. Because to be a, for instance, a military leader, you have to be hard-hearted to the cries of people. You know, the any physical ailments or emotional things that come up in a military situation. You know, these leaders have to pretty much pull yourself up by your bootstraps and go on. Of course, they get a little more rude, but you have to be able to turn that emotional field off. And I wouldn't make a good military leader. That's not me.
Well, I wouldn't either, because what often folks in the military are taught to do is to dehumanize the enemy.
Exactly.
And call them by names like, I mean, I'm not even going to repeat them because they're racial epithets, but they were used widely in World War II, in Vietnam, and throughout history to demonize people and to dehumanize them as though they're just something lower. They're just them over there, those people over there. We don't worry about those people over there because they're somehow less than we are. Mm-hmm. And I think often. And I'm proud to be an American. I'm happy to be an American. We live in a great country. But the people who were born in this country are no more human than the people who were born in Germany or in Indonesia or in the Sudan or any place else. We're no better. We're all human. And to dehumanize anybody because of the place where they happen to be born or the racial group that they happen to be born into or the gender that they happen to be born or the sexual orientation that they have is to falsely lift ourselves up because we're just too insecure to believe that we're not special. Well, everyone's special. Everyone is.
Right.
It's human, and everyone has something to contribute. And to dehumanize somebody else is just one of the worst things and the most unethical things I think that a person can do.
I agree. I just totally agree. So did you want to getting back to your book, Stephen, do you want to tell a little bit about a couple people in your book?
Well, one of the people that I profiled who is one of the more well-known folks is George Takei, who played Sulu on Star Trek. And I'm a Trekkie or a Trekker, if you prefer. And have long enjoyed that series, and I'm a big fan of George Takei's. I went to his play that he's putting on called Allegiance. Samara, my wife and I went down there, and
it was
absolutely phenomenal. It opened in the Old Globe Theater in San Diego, and we took a trip down there. And it's about George Takei actually plays two roles in the play. But it's about a family that is torn apart in World War II by the Japanese internment. And what does allegiance mean to you? Does it mean that you pledge allegiance to this flag? What does that mean? Does that mean that you end up serving your country regardless of what it does to your family or regardless of how it treats people who are like you? Why are these people put in concentration camps because of their ethnicity? And how do they respond to that? Their responses to that are very different. The different characters within the play are very different. And it's fascinating to see how they affect the family dynamic and how they view each other within their family. There's a romance, and I don't want to give too much away about the play, but it's just one of the best insights into human character and the way we deal with adversity that I've seen in a long time. So that was... George Takei was one of the people that I wanted to profile. I didn't profile a whole lot of really well-known people because I wanted to bring to the attention of readers a lot of people who maybe we don't know that much about or maybe have been forgotten by history. I don't know how many people, everyone's heard of Jackie Robinson, and I mentioned him a few times in the book. But I don't know that many people know that Jackie Robinson actually had a Rosa Parks-type experience in the military where he was brought up to a court-martial in 1944. This was before he was a baseball player. professional baseball player. He was on a bus and he was called the N word, and it caused a big stir. And he was court-martialed because he stood up to people. He said, "You're not going to call me that. I'm an officer.
Yeah.
I'm in the military. I deserve better." And he was court-martialed, and he was ultimately acquitted. But not many people know that about Jackie Robinson.
Mm-hmm.
And not many people know that Jackie Robinson, in his college days, baseball was his worst sport. He would have become a football player if he hadn't been injured and turned to baseball. And another guy who was on his team, a guy named Kenny Washington, both of them went to UCLA. Kenny Washington was actually probably a better baseball, or was a much better baseball player at UCLA. He was also a great football player. Kenny Washington became the first African American to play football in the National Football League. And so not many people know about it. And Kenny Washington is somebody probably most people don't know his name today, even though that was the case because he didn't play for that long. But before he was allowed to play professionally, he had many years where he starred in the West Coast Football League, the Pacific Coast Football League out here, which accepted African-American players. And it was only at the tail end of his career that he was able to become a part of the accepted, quote-unquote, professional sporting culture. And so he played 3 years, I believe, and then retired.
Hey, Jackie Robinson is one of my heroes because I just think he handled the discrimination thing so gracefully. And I think he was a lot of people's heroes for that reason. I don't want to take up much time on this, but I do have a little story that I'd like to share. My big hero is Curt Flood. Do you remember Curt Flood, the baseball player back in? Yeah, I met him.
Yeah.
It was 1961. I was 6 years old, and I had just been adopted into a family that I did not know and was still adjusting. And my dad was the Boy Scout or Cub Scout den leader, and he knew he was in public relations, so he knew the head of the manager of the St. Louis Cardinals baseball team. And asked him if he would send a player out to have dinner at a restaurant with the Cub Scouts. And they did. And at the last minute, they told him who it was and said it was going to be Curt Flood. Now, my parents, my mother's from the South, grew up there in the 1920s. They're not exactly open-minded, and I call them racists. They would deny it, but I call them racist. And from the minute we got to the restaurant and they saw that Curt Flood was a black man, there was so much tension in the air you could cut it with a knife. And they were furious, my mother especially, furious that they had, quote, sent us a black one.
Wow.
Yeah. And so I'm sitting here, and the thing that kept going through my little six-year-old mind was, wow, this is one of the very first black ball players. I wonder how that feels to him. And the entire meal was completely silent. Nobody said a word. Nobody talked to Curt Flood. And as soon as we finished, my parents stood up. As soon as we finished eating, my parents stood up, ready to go, put on their coats. So I turned to Curt Flood because I felt sorry for him. He was there by himself. He looked really uncomfortable. He was like 22 years old at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And I say to him, "So, Mr. Flood, how does it feel to be one of the first black baseball players?" Oh, my God, you would have thought that I had thrown a turd in the punch bowl. I mean, my parents went ballistic. And they're rushing me out of the restaurant, trying to rush me out of the restaurant. Curt Flood looked right in my eyes. He put his hands on my shoulders, and he said, "Little girl, what's your name?" And I told him my name. He said, "Well, Ariel, don't you ever, ever quit asking those kinds of questions. They're extremely important." And my parents are saying, "Oh, he's just being nice. He's just being nice." And he kept his eyes locked on mine. And here I am, just about dissolving in a whole puddle of shame, because I'd dropped the turd in the punch bowl. And he's reassuring me. And he's not only that, but this is 1961. He's standing up to a very powerful man. My dad was a big man. He was a rags-to-riches kind of guy, well-connected, and very intimidating. And Kurt Flood, at the age of like 22, stood up to him. And later on, I read his autobiography, and it's really quite a read. People spit on him from in the stands when he was out playing ball and things like that. He really had the courage of his convictions. He absolutely knew that he was right. He knew who he was. And later on, he sued the Cardinals because they were playing them hardly anything. They had to do public relations things almost every night and not get paid. And he took it all the way to the Supreme Court. He lost. But that's the kind of courage he had. So that's my story.
And I think, if I remember correctly, he's the person who brought in player unionization rights that
yes.
were not there before.
Yes, he's the one that did that. They also could get traded without, you know, any say-so and, you know, suddenly find out that they'd had to go to Japan or something and live there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and so he's the one, and he has yet to make it into the Hall of Fame. His family's really trying to get a campaign going to get him into the Hall of Fame because ball players ever since then owe everything they have to him. You know, that's why
mm-hmm.
they're making the big bucks now. But he's not remembered, except by people like
yeah.
us. So, yeah.
Well, now a few more people know about him.
Yeah.
That's
why
you know.
I'm almost sorry I didn't think of him to include in my book because he would have been a good person to profile.
Unfortunately, he died back in about 1997 or so.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to find him. It was the age of the internet had just come out. I desperately wanted to find him and found out he had just died like a year or two before. But I did connect with his daughter through Facebook, and I was able to tell the story to her because that was important.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah. Yeah. He was a good man.
That's wonderful.
A very good man and very vilified. Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway,
you know,
yeah, he would have been a good maybe in your second printing you can include that one. How's that?
Yeah. Yeah, I will definitely consider that. I thought of having additional volumes of this sort of thing with the same theme. So it's something that I will definitely consider in the future.
Mhm. Okay, well, I've got an article about him, so you can use that for information. Anyway.
Right.
Yeah. So now, where can we find your book, and where can we find your blog and all of that kind of stuff?
Well, all my books are available on Amazon, and most of them are available also on Nook. If you have a Nook reader or if you have a Kindle reader, they're all available there. I do want to mention that I actually have another book that's come out since Undefeated. It came out just this last week. It's called Feather Cap, and it's a it's a short story, and it's a fairy tale. And I think pagan parents and their children will find it just really enjoyable. It's about courage and sticking to your word, and just the magic of childhood and how that can inspire people. And I really enjoyed writing it. I wrote it last year for my wife as a Christmas present. And a Yule present, and I decided just this year that why don't I just share this with other people too? And I've got some pretty good response from it so far. It's just one of those things that I enjoyed really writing and wanted to share with people. And it's called Feather Cap. Undefeated is available on Nook and Kindle as well. And then my earlier books, The Gospel of the Phoenix and The Phoenix Principle, and A Requiem for a Phantom God, are also all available there as well.
Very cool.
Yes.
Okay.
You folks, well, I just wanted to say before we run out of time, you folks buy Undefeated to find out exactly what Rice Aroni has to do with all of this. You'll be fast.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you so much for being with us tonight, Stephen. It was just a wonderful pleasure, and as always, and you just keep cranking out the book. You've written, what, 5 in the last year or something?
Right.
Yeah.
And I'm working on my first novel now, and I'm hoping to get that out in February.
Oh, excellent. Okay, well, we might have to have you back on again then.
Well, I would certainly enjoy that.
Okay. All right, well, that's our show for tonight, everybody, and happy winter solstice. And wherever you are celebrating tomorrow, I hope that you take a little bit of time just to kind of do a little bit of a meditation on bringing more love into this world, because I think we really need it. And hopefully the Mayans are right, and tomorrow would be the first day of a brand new world. That would be wonderful. So I wish all of you happy Yule. And
happy Yule.
Happy Yule.
Happy Yule. So, marry me, and
marry part,
and marry meet again. Be safe. Good night, Tom and Aubrey.